Mr. Lake.
May it please the Court. The District Court here committed three reversible errors in certifying a class of all buyers of Conseco common stock between April 2001 and August 2002. First, by allowing plaintiffs to invoke the fraud in the market presumption of reliance without proof that the alleged misstatements and omissions at issue here were material, that is, that they affected Conseco's stock price.
You know, I don't see the plaintiffs as arguing that materiality is irrelevant to the fraud on the market analysis. I see them saying that their expert demonstrated materiality with that event study. And are you questioning the adequacy of the expert's showing, and if so, what evidence do you have in the record to the contrary? In other words, what evidence do you have to show that the expert was wrong? For example, that the prices did not drop when the truth came to light.
Defendants in this case do not challenge, in this court, do not challenge the expert's work with respect to demonstrating the efficiency of the market with respect to Conseco stock generally. However, defendant or plaintiff's expert Feinstein conceded that he did not render any opinion or do any analysis regarding what effect, if any, the alleged misstatements or omissions on which they based their claims affected the stock price. So in our view, there are two separate elements.
It sounds like we're getting ahead of the game, however. The only question at this stage is whether a class can be certified. They're obviously going to have to prove materiality in order to win. Bison against Carlisle and Jacqueline says you don't have to show that you win in order to get a class certified. So why are we worried at this stage about materiality?
Materiality is unquestionably an element of plaintiff's claims at the merits, but it is also one of the four elements necessary to invoke the fraud in the market presumption under BASIC. And under this Court's rulings in Szabo and West, the fact that an issue relevant to class certification is also relevant to an issue on the merits does not immunize that issue with respect to plaintiff's class certification burden. Indeed,
I certainly understand Szabo, but what part of BASIC says that in order to get a class certified, you have to show materiality?
BASIC in Note 27 identified the four elements necessary to invoke the fraud in the market presumption. It's plaintiff's burden at rule.
That's the merits. My question is, what part of BASIC says you have to show materiality to get a class certified?
The only part of BASIC that relates to class is Note 29 and the last phrase of BASIC, which says that this analysis may affect class. But the effect on class simply stems from first principles of Rule 23. Plaintiffs must be able to establish that proof at trial would be common, and therefore, just like plaintiffs have to demonstrate that the market is efficient, such that they can demonstrate they can invoke the presumption, this is simply another element necessary to demonstrate their entitlement to invoke
the presumption. At that point, we seem to have abandoned the difference between winning on the merits and certifying a class, and then we really are in the Eisen soup.
As Judge Tallman explained in the Ninth Circuit dissent in America West, materiality in a securities fraud class action comes in at two points in the equation. First, it's an element of the fraud in the market presumption, just like market efficiency. There's no difference between market efficiency and the materiality of misstatements. They are both elements necessary to invoke the fraud in the market presumption. That it overlaps with the merits is not unlike other cases where you can have an issue germane both to the merits and the class certification inquiry. And indeed, every appellate court that has considered the question has concluded that materiality is an issue at class certification, and that where plaintiffs have not demonstrated all four elements of the fraud in the market presumption, they cannot win at class. For example, the Fourth Circuit in Garrity and the First Circuit in Polymedica, both were situations where plaintiffs had not established evidence of one of the elements of the fraud in the market presumption. In Garrity, plaintiffs did not demonstrate that defendants made any public misstatements, and in Polymedica, plaintiffs did not demonstrate that the stock market at issue, that the stock at issue was efficiently traded. And in both those cases, the court concluded that where a plaintiff does not demonstrate its ability to invoke the fraud in the market presumption at the class phase, reliance would be individualized. Here, like in Polymedica, where it's the efficiency of the market, like in Garrity, where it's the public nature of the statements, here we're simply under another element of the fraud in the market presumption.
If we were to find against you on the fraud on the market question, would you concede that most of your argument about whether common questions predominate falls away? What remains of your common questions argument if the plaintiffs are entitled to the fraud on the market presumption?
Even if proof of reliance would be common at trial, that is, even if plaintiffs had demonstrated that they could invoke the fraud in the market presumption, common questions, the district court still erred in its predominance ruling, and that's for two primary reasons. First, the district court committed legal error by equating the predominance inquiry with an efficiency test, comparing a class trial to a series of individual trials and considering over everything else whether a class trial would be more efficient. That analysis is backwards. Where common questions predominate, obviously a class trial would be more efficient. But efficiency is only a necessary but insufficient condition, and indeed the district court's test would amount to a per se rule in favor of certification in securities fraud case. And the correct analysis is whether individual or common questions would predominate at trial. Even putting reliance to the side, the predominant standard could not be met here. And the primary reason for that is that the district judge here made findings, and those findings cannot be reconciled with the predominance conclusion. For example, the district court concluded that loss causation determinations may be different for different class members. The district court found that each class member may not have a claim against each defendant. And the district court found...
But why is that dispositive? This court decided maybe 6 weeks ago in the case called Cohen against Pacific Investment Management that that doesn't prevent a class from being certified. Now, I notice that you don't discuss Cohen. I wonder if there's any way to reconcile your position with Cohen.
We filed a supplemental authority with respect to Cohen, and our view is that it does not affect the analysis here. And the reason is that although the Cohen case acknowledges the possibility, indeed the inevitability, that any class certified would have some number of uninjured class members, the Cohen court went on to say that where many class members were uninjured, no class can be certified. And for that proposition, the court cited the Oshana case, which says that plaintiffs have a burden to demonstrate that common questions would predominate as to each class member. Here the district court concluded, it made a finding, that some buyers did not actually suffer damages, and for good reason on this record. And so in our view, that common questions do not predominate is perfectly consistent with this court's ruling in Cohen, which incidentally did not relate to plaintiff's ability to invoke the fraud in the market presumption because it was a commodities future exchange.
Of course, as for whether the trial of the case would be unmanageable as a class action, the standard of review, of course, is abuse of discretion. And I tried to see where you had pointed out legal errors in the district court's analysis, because it's very difficult to show abuse of discretion if you can't, you know, show a legal error. And that's where I came up against a hard rock. It's just hard to see how the case would be less manageable as a class action than it would be as a series of individual actions. I mean, you know, clearly there are some issues, such as damages, on which the individual plaintiffs are going to have to make individualized proof. But that would be true, I think, whether it was tried as a class action or as an individual, you know, as individual cases. And, of course, there are a lot of issues that are common to all the plaintiffs and to many, if not all, of the defendants. So So help me.
The fundamental problem with respect to the court's manageability ruling is that there was no record that supported the ruling. And the reason is the plaintiffs were very clear. They told the district judge, there is no requirement in this court that we provide this court, the district judge, with any guidance as to how this case should be tried.
Yeah.
So there's no trial plan. There's no proposed jury instructions. And pursuant to Eisen, the court evaluated, as it must, the range of practical problems that a class trial would raise. And it made specific findings that there were discrete, real, tangible, practical problems with how a class trial would be managed. And there was nothing on this record for plaintiffs to surmount those practical problems. They didn't say, we're going to try the case in this way to surmount those problems. There's nothing there. So the district court's conclusion cannot be supported by the record that was developed by the plaintiffs. And as in all inquiries under Rule 23, it's plaintiffs' primary burden to demonstrate the manageability of a class trial. This case is unique in that materiality and loss causation arise in a unique context of the materialization of risk plaintiff's materialization of risk theory. Usually, in the usual case, there's a lie. When the lie is disclosed to the market, the stock price falls. That's not what plaintiffs allege here. Plaintiffs allege that the...
When the truth is disclosed to the market, the price falls.
Yes, when the truth is disclosed. Plaintiffs allege here that the truth wasn't disclosed during the class period. It wasn't found out till much later. They attribute damages to a series of ambiguous events, analyst downgrades, analyst statements about Conseco stock that on their face can't be tied to a particular misstatement or omission. Demonstrating causation, demonstrating the materiality of the particular statements and omissions at issue, that is, that they move the market, will require plaintiffs to engage in a significant process, that is, to identify the causes for those ambiguous events and then to tie those ambiguous events, the causes for those events, to the misstatements and omissions at issue. The jury here will have to piece together a defendant with a misstatement with a materialization. And because those factors change with respect to each day that Conseco stock was bought and each day it was sold, it will have to do that in a Rubik's Cube fashion for every day, every possible buy-sell.
I'm beginning to think that you're just complaining about the fraud on the market theory, because I think what you just said could be said in every fraud on the market case.
The difference between this case and a fraud in the market case, and indeed in this court's decision in Ray, the court distinguished a materialization of risk case from a fraud in the market case because a materialization of risk case requires this disaggregation, disambiguation of the materialization event to determine whether it in fact was caused by the misstatements at issue. If there are no further questions, I'll save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Lake. Mr. Binka.
Good morning. May it please the court. This appeal represents today an appeal of a well-thought-out order from the district court, an order that was based upon a substantial evidentiary showing by the plaintiffs in this case, and in response, essentially no evidentiary showing from the defendants. Instead, what the defendants proposed today is for this court to adopt a new standard based upon what we believe are unsubstantiated legal arguments, which are based upon outlier decisions from the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which we believe contradict the teachings of Basic v. Levinson.
Are you arguing that materiality is irrelevant to the issue of whether the plaintiffs are entitled to the fraud on the market presumption, or are you contending that your expert met the burden on materiality by demonstrating that stock prices fell when the truth came to light?
Well, we're arguing two things. First, we're arguing that, yes, the expert has made a showing of materiality, which is unrebutted by the defendants. And secondly, that While materiality certainly is an element of ultimately proving reliance on the fraud of the market theory, that the inquiry into materiality does not inform the Rule 23 question of predominance.
Could I go back to the first part of your response?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Because as I recall, the defendants in the gray brief at 7 and 8 talked about they stated that your expert was not asked to assess market reaction to materialization of risks related to the information that had allegedly been concealed by the defendants. Is that true?
Yes, our expert's assignment was to determine, and our expert is an expert in economics and finance, whether there was an efficient market under the standards in his field. He's not an attorney. He wasn't asked to assess the legal claim.
But
as it turns out, I'm sorry.
Well, I hate to interrupt, but did the expert fail to tie these third-party reports of bad news about Kinesco to the defendant's specific misrepresentations or concealed facts?
Well, what the expert did is he did tie the reports on the dates we claim are materialization of the risk to the stock price declines on those dates. And separating out the abnormal return determined there's a relation. At the motion to dismiss, the court, of course, had already made, at the pleading stage, an analytical determination that there was a viable theory of relation between those dates and the alleged misrepresentations. The expert himself did not go beyond that because, as he said, there's no empirical basis as a financial expert to make that finding. And a point we made specifically in the argument to the district court was that, and just if I could back up just a second, at the district court level, the defendants used loss causation to attack his findings, not to claim that materiality was part of the inquiry. And they said his findings were inadequate or faulty because he had not made this finding. As we pointed out, the defendants not only did not provide their own expert report claiming there was lack of efficiency, they did not have an expert saying that his methodology was improper or any academic literature saying that his methodology was improper because, as an empirical matter, his findings were accurate. And that's, you know, now they've dropped their attack on his efficiency report today. Instead, they tried to change their argument from claiming that loss causation was necessary to show efficiency as an empirical matter to a legal argument where they're trying to not only slip loss causation but actually an improper standard of market effect into the fraud on the market presumption.
Are you saying that's a brand new argument?
In a sense, they did.
Is that because I think I saw the seeds of that somewhere?
Well, at the district court level, the defendants argued that the efficiency finding was inadequate because he had not shown loss causation. Today, and there are some similarities, they're still asking the court to adopt a standard of loss causation, but now instead of an empirical argument claiming that there's a lack of efficiency, they're now claiming that we haven't shown materiality because we haven't shown a market impact, which is not only incorrect under BASIC, but would not inform the Rule 23 inquiry itself. Because, of course, as an analytical matter, for example, if our class representatives went to trial and are unable to show efficiency, then, of course, you might have individual class members coming in saying, well, maybe the market's inefficient, but I read those statements and relied upon them. And, of course, that's the classic case. Whereas, ultimately, if there's not a showing of materiality,
That would end the claim for all class members. There would be no reason to bring class members into the court because, as we know, materiality is the objective reasonable investor standard. And while that affords plaintiffs a modicum of proof in order to be able to prove these cases, it also limits them. You can't opt out of it. You know, a plaintiff can't say, well, it's not material for the market, but it is material to me. That can never happen. So that's why, although we have made a showing of materiality which is unrebutted, a further inquiry into it would not inform the predominance question of Rule 23. It might ultimately inform the question of can we prove materiality, but that will necessarily be a class-wide issue, as materiality always is. And we believe that the defendants have also proposed the incorrect standard for that. Relying upon the Fifth Circuit decisions in Greenberg v. Crossroads and Oscar Private Equity, the defendants claim that we have to show market impact in order to show materiality. Now, in Basic v. Levinson, and this is at 485 U.S. at 247, excuse me, the court said, for the purposes of 10b-5 actions, the court must presume that a material misstatement distorted the efficient market price because, quote, because most publicly available information is reflected in the market price. In this court's jurisprudence in Asher v. Baxter, and this is at 377 F3rd 731, says once proved efficient, a market reflects all material information, not just some. So essentially, defendant's argument tries to turn that on its head. Instead of the presumption gaining the benefits of the presumption for plaintiffs, they're now trying to make the market impact the predicate for the presumption, which is obviously what Basic doesn't say. And I think it's worth bearing in mind, of course, that 10B actions are implied right of actions. And the courts have developed rules applying common law fraud rules to these actions in order to determine what must be proved. And in the context of, you know, our broad impersonal markets, the courts, especially the Supreme Court, has made determinations. Like in TSC Industries, it said, okay, you can prove materiality through the objective investor standard. And in Basic v. Levinson, the court said, this is how we're going to apportion proof. If defendants can, you know, if the plaintiffs can make a showing that materially false statements were issued into an efficient market, there's now a rebuttable presumption, and it's now defendant's burden to break that presumption. And in Basic, the court specifically said that one way the defendants could break the presumption was to show, if the defendants could show that the market price would not have been affected by the misrepresentations. Now, instead, defendants are saying, oh, well, now the plaintiffs have to show that the market price was affected, and that's so that's essentially reverse of that. In the Second Circuit, in the In re Solomon multimedia case, and this is at 544 F3rd 474, and we mentioned this at page 32 of our brief, says that materiality is the reasonable investor standard and specifically rejects that there has to be a finding of market impact for this purpose. So, you know, we would essentially say three things: that we have shown some market impact, that further inquiry does not inform the predominance requirement, and regardless, defendants have proposed the wrong standard, that we have to show some sort of market impact to show materiality. Similarly, we think whatever argument the defendants are making regarding loss causation any further inquiry will not inform the Rule 23 finding, because loss causation will necessarily now be found by common issues, now that we've shown that there is an efficient market. And in doing that, our expert did show there was a link on certain of these dates between the statements issued and the price reaction. And as the court knows, loss causation is really a matter of proximate causation. And the Second Circuit in the Lentel case stated it this way: a misstatement or omission is the proximate cause of an investment loss if the risk that caused the loss was within the zone of risk concealed by the misrepresentations and omissions. And this is tort principles that, you know, go back as far as Paul's graph, and in the sense that If defendants put a series of events into play, they're going to be responsible for injuries that are proximately caused by those events. So defendants attempt to cast our case repeatedly as some sort of unusual or strange case, but it's not. It's really long-established tort principles and rules of the common law and fraud. And frauds of this sort have been going on for hundreds of years, and victims have been had their rights adjudicated through the rule of law by courts for a long time. And bad actors have been convincing investors to invest investments by misleading them as to conditions or risks, and then when things go bad due to those risks, they recover. It doesn't require a mea culpa by the defendant or some investigative reporter to show fact by fact that the defendant was lying. This type of fraud has been enforced by the market for many years. So we would assert, and other courts have found this outside the Fifth Circuit, that although the loss causation inquiry is going to be very important here, we've never denied that, it's going to be a class-wide inquiry. And so while the court should make any factual findings that are necessary for Rule 23, this finding and finding of materiality just will not inform the predominance question. Turning to the issues of the predominance of the other issues the court mentions, the defendants try to suggest that the district court didn't consider these matters, but I think it's pretty clear the court did. Not only is in our briefing, but for example, in our oral argument, and this would be, Supplemental Appendix 87, the court begins to ask questions about that, and there's somewhat detailed explanation of that. And in arguing that, I even specifically went through, at the court's request, what a potential verdict form would look like and how the issues would work and how it would be manageable. And the district court, having managed many cases, agreed that it's a complex case, but federal district courts are more than capable of adjudicating complex cases. But what the important inquiry here, and the court did this, is that in trying their case, plaintiffs Schleicher and Lanise will, for the purposes of liability, almost entirely present the same evidence and testimony and documents as any class member would on any of the issues in question. And the court went through the elements of the claim one by one, and they're all either clearly objective standards or under the theory alleged and what's been shown, questions that will be directed only at the defendant's actions in this case. So while defendants make a good effort at showing the case will be complicated, and they're right, the resolution of certain issues, some class members may end up with claims and some may not, but that's a matter of differential effect instead of differential proof. And there's never been a class denied on the basis of that the ultimate resolution of the issues might ultimately eliminate some class members from recovery and give other class members recovery. The important thing is it's not going to change the adjudication of the issues at all. And we went through this very carefully with the district court, and we could see at the court's order in Appendix 24 to 25, the court did consider these items. And to the degree that, defendants had really believed that certain issues were threshold issues or were disposed of the case, courts are able to deal with this in many ways. Of course, the Rule 16 or 26 or Rule 56 summary judgment motions. And it bears noting here that the case management order in this case, which defendants stipulated to with us, merits discovery is proceeded coterminously with class discovery. There's no bifurcation. And we've specifically agreed on a procedure where expert discovery, which will look at loss causation and potentially other issues, will follow merits discovery. And if we're talking about a case management procedure, the court is more than able to manage not only this case but any case before it, a class action or otherwise. So we really believe these items have been covered, and defendants have actually somewhat, you know, changed their argument, but they've always argued that loss causation should be part of the analysis. But really, whether it's as an empirical matter or an inquiry that informs Rule 23, it clearly has no place in this proceeding. It will have a place down the line, and we will address it at that time. If the court has no further questions.
Anything further, Mr. Layton?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple discrete points. First, on the waiver point, on page 15 of our opposition to plaintiff's class motion, defendants said that plaintiffs have not attempted to show that the fraudulent statements move the market. In oral argument at page 30, there must be a cause and effect relationship between material information becoming known and a change in the share price. That's exactly the argument we're raising now. Second, plaintiff's expert did not demonstrate the materiality of the misstatements at issue. Materiality, of course, depends on whether a statement changes the total mix of information. It focuses on the statement. Whether that means, in the context of a fraud in the market case, whether the market price moved in response to the statement. What plaintiff's expert did is he looked at days on which there were ambiguous events, that is, an analyst downgrade, and said that, yes, on that package of information, Conseco's price moved. But he did not tie that to the misstatements and omissions at issue. He did not claim otherwise, and he cannot claim otherwise. Plaintiffs say that they established it at the pleading phase under Szabo. That is clearly incompatible with Seventh Circuit law. Plaintiffs at the class phase must proffer evidence in support to satisfy their Rule 23 burdens. Most importantly, materiality must be established at the class phase. This court in Flam said that plaintiffs' ability to invoke the fraud in the market presumption was an important ingredient to their ability to demonstrate that common questions would predominate at trial. That's perfectly consistent with the Second Circuit opinion in Solomon, with the Fifth Circuit opinion in Oscar, both of which interpreted BASIC as requiring such proof at the class certification phase. And the reason for that is that unless plaintiffs are able to invoke the fraud in the market presumption, individual proof of reliance will predominate at trial. Therefore, plaintiffs, as in any presumption under Federal Rule of Evidence 301, in order for the trial judge to instruct the jury that they may infer that the plaintiffs relied on the integrity of the market, plaintiffs must establish the basic facts that support that presumption. And that's just Federal Rule of Evidence 301. What are the basic facts here? The basic opinion tells us it includes market efficiency, to be sure, and that issue has been litigated over and over again. It also includes materiality, that is, whether the particular statements, misstatements, and omissions at issue change the total mix of information, which in a fraud in the market case means that they changed the market price, because in a fraud in the market case, the reasonable investor is the market itself, and that's Flam and Eckstein and Asher. All state that in a fraud in the market case, we demonstrate materiality by looking at what happened to the market price when that information was disclosed to the market. Therefore, in order to invoke the fraud in the market presumption and demonstrate that proof of reliance would be common at trial, plaintiffs must establish all the elements, including materiality. Plaintiffs have not done that here. They cite BASIC for the proposition for the first time that somehow a price effect may be presumed when the market is efficient. But the very portion of BASIC that plaintiffs' counsel quoted from said that where information is material, we may presume that all information or most information, as BASIC said, is incorporated into the market price. Indeed, on page 247 of that opinion, the court said, nearly every court has concluded that where materially misleading statements have been disseminated into a market, the reliance on integrity of the market may be presumed. And this court in Asher followed up on that by saying that only when the statements affect the price, only when the particular misstatements and omissions on which plaintiffs base their claim, only when those statements affect the price, can we substitute reliance on the integrity of the market for reliance on those particular misstatements. And therefore, because plaintiffs did not demonstrate the materiality of any misstatements or omissions at issue, common questions would predominate. One final point on manageability. It's certainly true that at oral argument, plaintiff's counsel had a discussion with the district judge about what may be on the verdict form and how the case might be tried. At that late date, however, plaintiffs did not establish any of the contours of how the case would be tried. For example, what the jury instructions would be, how the case would be divided along liability or damages lines. Indeed, the district judge expressed some skepticism with the way that the plaintiffs proposed the class argument, noting in a footnote that the way that they suggested it raised significant Seventh Amendment problems. So on this record, their plaintiffs have no antidote to the practical problems, to the findings that the district judge recognized would preclude a manageable class action. This is not a case unlike Carnegie against Household, where we have to worry about the alternative to this case being no litigation at all. In the Carnegie case, of course, the amount of damages at issue were $15 or $30. Here, the two named plaintiffs between them have damages of over $3 million, they say. This is not a case in which we have to worry about what the alternative is. We know what the alternative is. More importantly, Rule 23 sets out a regime for plaintiffs to meet their burden that the case can be tried with common evidence at trial, that those common questions would predominate, and that a class trial would be manageable.
Thank you, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.